KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. I was just talking to my guests, and we were reminding each other we met at what was the blackest Oscars in movie history of a couple of years ago. He has now come around to make what is probably the blackest Spider-Man, probably the blackest Marvel movie in history. He is one of the directors of Across the Spider-Verse. He is an Oscar nominee for his screenplay, his adaptation of his play, One Night in Miami. And he also had another Oscar-nominated movie up that same year, Soul. My guest is writer, director, playwright, Kemp Powers. Kemp, I would love to talk to you both completely out of time going through all of your credits here. you know, it's funny, in watching this movie, first of all, I found myself thinking of Miyazaki, because in terms of length and density, it has that kind of feel of something that we haven't really seen in American animation before.
The first Spider-Verse, I think, was close to 2 hours. And it's one of those weird things where you're making the film and it's super duper long. And we keep saying to one another, like, okay, eventually we're going to have to trim this down. And we start trimming. And I mean, understand, animation's an iterative process. So when you're in storyboards, we had versions of this film that was so much longer. But then you get to a certain point where you're recording the voice actors and you're making the film and you're like, okay, it's long, but we'll trim it. We'll trim it. And the parts of the film you're planning to trim, you keep on like kicking the can down the road. And the next thing you know, those parts have been laid out. They're starting to be animated and it's going like, yeah, we'll trim it. And then the next thing you know, the film is pretty much done. And we're looking at each other like, well, what else is it that we'd want to cut? And it's like nothing. So, I mean, I got to give Sony, Tom Rothman and the folks at Sony a lot of credit for letting us do that. Because our question we asked each other were, do you stay engaged? And if the audience that we're screening it to is engaged, then what is it with this idea that if it's an animated feature, it has to be 85 or 90 minutes? Why can't it be a bit longer?
Well, but that's why I felt like specifically stuff like Princess Mononoke, these movies that are really big and have a lot of emotional coloration in them and have a lot of characters, and each act feels like its own discrete piece, but lends itself to the larger narrative. That's why certainly it felt to me like that kind of scale.
I mean, yeah, we're all huge fans of that. And the way we construct these films scene by scene, every scene is basically like a self-contained, I mean, no pun intended, like it's basically a self-contained stage play.
It's funny you say stage play, because there's a scene near the end with Gwen Stacy and her father where there are sort of almost like lighting changes that feel like you're watching a two-character piece.
I mean, that's pretty much what that is. I mean, Justin K. Thompson, one of my fellow directors, you know, he was really one of the driving forces behind the look of Gwen Stacy's world, which was always one that was supposed to be reflective of like a mood ring where basically, depending on her emotions, things change in the world around her.
When you said mood ring, the sort of the layering of watercolors, the fact that, you know, conventional background disappears, and it really is about the coloration of all the things that she's going through. We can see all the emotional changes that her father's going through just by looking at the backdrop rather than watching their faces or listening to their voices. And I thought that was, as you were talking about a stage play, that really felt like that to me. And if it were like a two-hander with just a maybe no wall and just lighting changes, because you can change perspective by changing lighting, can't you?
Yeah, and that's exactly it. And look, I'm a writer, so this is kind of blasphemy for me to say this, but we wanted the scene to work incredibly well, vote audibly based on the performances of the actors. I mean, Shea Whigham and Haley Steinfeld did amazing character work on that scene. But because of the visuals, we also wanted it to be a scene that you could tell what was happening emotionally, even if the sound was off. I have this habit when I'm flying on airplanes. There's a lot of films that I will watch on an airplane. I know the film, of course, but I watch them with the sound off. And over the years of doing that, I started noticing certain films that I could track it a lot better without any sound. And that's the case with a scene like this. It's like, based on the changes in the color, changes on the mood, you can visibly see the reconciliation, the emotion, the anger, what is happening between the characters without hearing any of the dialogue.
It's the treat with that sound you heard. It was the sound of writer's hearts breaking everywhere, inflicted by my guest, Kent Powers, who's one of the co-directors of Across the Spider-Verse. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. There's a lot of bright coloration in that, and then, which is kind of a penultimate scene, and then the ultimate, which I won't give away, it gets physically darker. I mean, it's almost yes. like the sun disappears from this world.
Yes, that's exactly it. I mean, the darkness of the situation that the character is in, the darkness that the world inhabits, all of that is incredibly evident. It was done on purpose. And that scene in the film, we had it in the film for a long time, but we just kept on tweaking it. The VizDev team, we just kept on tweaking the look of it down to the last minute, because for reasons I won't spoil, we don't want the look of the scene to give away certain elements of the plot. So it was about really balancing that darkness with the need to allow people to be somewhat surprised, at least when there's a big reveal in that moment in the scene.
That scene, as light just sort of starts to disappear, it starts off seemingly about darkness in one way and becomes something else entirely.
The ending of our film, I'm sure, is going to be a divisive subject, because of course we end the film on a bit of a cliffhanger.
What? Spoiler alert. Yeah, oh my god. And, I mean, but it even has the classic sort of Marvel Comics cliffhanger of a to be continued panel with an ellipse at the end.
It's so, when you hear you say it, it's so funny, because these things you're pointing out were things we went back and forth on again and again and again, up until they basically fried the film from our fingers. There was a long period of time when we had no to be continued. And it was
really?
Like, wait a minute. Is it? Yeah. It was like, are we going to put to be continued? It was like, oh, put it in. Then we'd put it in and say, well, no, we shouldn't do to be continued. Then we pull it back out. And it's just the clock ran out. And myself, the other directors, Phil Lord, Chris Miller, our producers were just like, okay, leaving the to be continued. But it's hilarious that you're pointing out some of the things that we worked on and tweaked and worked the longest. I mean, you mentioned that scene between Gwen and her dad. I mean, that was a scene that I felt like the actors were going to choke us after a while, because we kept bringing them back in and rewriting and re-recording that scene over and over and over again. And I could see the look in Shea Whigham's face like, what's going on? Like, I had to reassure him, dude, it's not your performance. It's not you. It's us. We're psychos. Like, we can't make up our minds. So that's the reason we keep on dragging you back in here and rewriting and reworking this scene. We usually record all the actors separately, but this film, I think everyone was separate in the first film, I was told. But in this film, there were several times we brought in both actors to work face to face. And one of the first ones we did was actually bringing in Shay and Haley together and letting them actually act off of one another, which is something that does not happen very often in animation voiceover work.
One of the things I want to ask you about is, you may be the only director who's done back-to-back animation films where death is a character more or less in the film.
Look, man, I'm a dark dude. I'm not going to apologize for that, because you have to understand, one of my favorite animated features of all time terrified me, and that was Watership Down. So going back to old films like The Dark Crystal and The Secret of Nim, but you know, those are kind of like seminal cartoons and films from my childhood. And in many ways, I think animated films are a wonderful opportunity to introduce young people to kids to this idea. I mean, look at Bambi. I mean, let's talk about one of the most famous animated films of all time. And of course, we all know the scene in Bambi where mom is like, Bambi, don't look back, run. You hear the gunshot. And the next thing you know, Bambi is like, no account dad shows up and is like, you're living with me now. I guess I just think about these things a lot. And I just want to explore films that go a little bit deeper, a little bit below, you know, I want to dig beneath the surface. I don't think animation should be dumbed down, not just intellectually, but also emotionally. And part of it is because I also work in theater and live action. So I see the mediums as different, but I see the stories I'm trying to tell as essentially the same. Like, truth be told, bad language notwithstanding, I wrote the stage play One Night in Miami for young adults. That was the plan. Like I said, I wanted to write a play so that 17-year-olds could get into these historical figures. So people were like, well, what are you talking about? They cursed the whole time. I'm like, have you been around 17-year-olds? Like, they should totally lean into these guys with this language. So I didn't realize I was doing it, but I was always writing towards my 15, 16, 17-year-old self, even as a playwright.
Because death exists basically as kind of a character in One Night in Miami as well. And I wanted to talk to you about that just because these projects are all in the ways about the sort of the basically getting past the anxiety about death and then deciding what you're going to do with your life once you make that decision. And I want to ask you where that comes from, because that's a pretty interesting piece thematically to find in all of your work at this early stage of your film career.
I mean, if I'm being perfectly honest, it's something that I struggle with myself quite a bit. I developed pretty debilitating anxiety in my mid to late 20s that took me a few years to kind of work through. The death of my own father from lung cancer, really back in like 2003, really struck me and got me thinking about my own mortality. And there's a lot of films that coincidentally came out around that time that tackled the subject matter so eloquently that in many ways, I think I kind of came into this business aspiring to that type of work. A great example, 2002, about Schmidt. That's the film that made me say to myself, I think I want to give a go at trying to make movies, trying to write films. Alexander Payne's About Schmidt. Jack Nicholson plays this guy. The film opens with him watching the clock wind down, the minutes, the seconds to his retirement, and then not knowing what to do with the rest of his life. It's funny, but sad and also stark. And I mind a lot of that same kind of emotional space when co-writing and co-directing Soul, which again had people saying, well, did you forget this is for kids? And it's like, no, we didn't. Like, but it's just, I don't know. I guess it's just something that rolls around in my head and something that I find myself thinking about a lot. And I have for a long time.
Are you talking about Schmidt? It's really, you can see the joins between it and One Night in Miami, which is almost the sort of sensation of being in God's waiting room, as you used to say in the old Baptist church. And once you get past this anxiety about this worst thing that could happen to you, this thing that feels like it's life ending, but your life hasn't ended yet. Obviously, the difference between about Schmidt and Soul and Across the Spider-Verse, and even Soul, is people who aren't at the end of their lives, who are fairly young, who have to deal with. And this, that clearly gets back to what you're saying about being a young person yourself and having to sort of look into the future past calamity.
I was a very late bloomer in my creative career. I mean, this is all the second career to me. I was a journalist for 17 years who was always writing creatively on the side and for fun and just kind of looking at this idea of like, man, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to do this thing that I thought when I was a freshman in college and my friends and I were making our own independent comic books, and it felt like the world was our oyster. And then I blinked and I was, you know, a divorced man with two kids and just working on a career that was kind of closing in on me. And it was like, wow, I don't know if this is going to work out. And you hit that fork in the road and it's like, well, you're going to have to be okay with just plowing forward and being that weird eccentric friend who everyone says, yeah, he still thinks his plays are going to get produced, or he's going to write movies and TV one day, or just giving up on it completely. And again, that fork in the road just came at a really opportune moment for me when people finally started taking note of my voice and my work. I finally started finding my audience, because that's really what all of this is about, right? Is connecting your work to the people who it moves. I've been writing the way I write for my entire life and just running into brick wall after brick wall after brick wall. And it was just about the perfect timing of something that I wrote being presented to a group of people who that group of people just seemed to connect to it. And I have no explanation for how or why that happened, but I'm really thankful that it did. It helped pull me out of my own existential malaise, I guess we could say.
Good. We always like to go to the break on a moment of existential crisis. My guest, who's clearly got past all of that, is Kent Powers. His most recent film, you may have heard of it, is Across the Spider-Verse. He's one of its co-directors. He also is an Oscar nominee for his adaptation of his play One Night in Miami. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. We're lightening the mood. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is Kent Powers, one of the co-directors of the amazing, can you use the word amazing and not say Spider-Man? Anyway, Across the Spider-Verse is the film. His recent triumphs, of course, include co-directing Soul, the Pixar feature, and adapting his play One Night in Miami into a film directed by Regina King. You are succeeding in two areas which had thought to been sort of closed off to people of color. And that was, you know, you talked about doing comics as a kid and then also in animation. And these are two areas that there can be at the very least a Maginot line of not an actual impediment for people of color to have any kind of achievement in these worlds.
Yeah, it is pretty interesting. I mean, there was a great piece I read years back in Vanity Fair that kind of broke down the history behind Pixar, which I've always been fascinated with Pixar, just because, just as a storyteller, I've always thought of that place as like the house of master storytelling. You know, like some of the best films I've ever seen. I'm talking like Ratatouille, WALL-E, Up, Inside Out. I couldn't understand how they pulled all these things together, and that's what originally drew me to Pixar. It was less about it being wanting to get into animation. It was more about kind of wanting to be in this environment with these master storytellers to not just be working on the film, but also to be learning from a group of people who I felt had just, I don't know, just delivered some of the greatest stories I'd ever seen on the screen. So animation was almost secondary. And that was something I had to learn a lot about on the job. It's just, I was incredibly fortunate to have someone like a Pete Docter, who's one of the best in the business, who I'm not only working with him, but he's also in kind of like a mentorship role as we're working together on Soul. And a lot of the folks in the Pixar Brain Trust. So you learn about the process organically as you're just trying to figure out how to execute this story. I didn't really know much about the history, or dare I should say the lack of history of Black people in animation. I knew a lot more about it in comic books, because when I was younger, I mean, Larry Stroman, his run on X-Force was such a big deal to me. For like a Black guy to be drawing one of the X-Men comic books was like tremendous.
And you were coming up about the time too of Milestone, right?
Absolutely. I'd met Dwayne McDuffie and Dennis Cowan. They actually came to our little booth at Comic Fest in Philadelphia and bought like a bunch of our stuff. It was a great time. I mean, there was Brother Man was another comic book, an indie comic book that would be
out
going
of Washington,
around
Washington, D.C.
Yeah, by Washington, D.C. You'd always buy it at the Black Expos. We used to travel and do the Black Expos. So it was an exciting time to be a Black creator in comics, because a lot of folks were doing that kind of thing. But again, my knowledge of the history, that lack of representation in animation, I didn't realize it until I was already doing it. And in that sense, I guess ignorance was kind of bliss. When you don't know any better, you're just kind of like, well, I'm just here trying to make this movie Soul. And that's my complete focus. And everything else is just noise. And so I guess that kind of worked in my favor.
It's The Treatment. My guest is Kent Powers. He's one of the co-directors of Across the Spider-Verse. And we know him for his co-directing work on Soul and his adaptation of his play One Night in Miami into the screenplay, which for which he's nominated for the Oscar. You can also see the show at KCRW.com. When I met Donald Glover in 2006 in Austin, and it was when the internet swirl and consequent contradump was starting about him possibly playing Spider-Man. And I said the thing that everybody says was, you know, Spider-Man always felt like a Black character anyway, because he worked to save the world and nobody treated him like anything other than a criminal. And Donald said, not only that, but every young person I knew growing up in Queens raised by either an aunt or a grandmother was Black. So that doesn't mean Spider-Man is Black. I don't know what is. So there's something at the heart of the character that really connects to our community, isn't there?
There is. And what an incredible irony on top of that, that one of the things that separates and makes Miles so distinct from Peter Parker is he has both parents at home. and they're totally like 100% involved helicopter parents. That's the most hilarious irony, is that one of the most distinctive things about Miles versus Peter Parker is he isn't being raised by an aunt. He's being raised by not only two parents, his dad's a freaking cop. And so I agree that, like, when you think about that, that should be the case. But one of the things that makes Miles special is he so contradicts the idea of what you expect a character like this or a family like this to look like and sound like and behave like. And it's honestly one of the things that really drew me in on the first film and drew me towards the character. That's why I was so passionate about wanting to expand the presence of both Miles's mom, Rio, and his dad, Jeff. And also, being selfish, Brian Tyree Henry and Luna Lauren Velez, who are the actors who voice them, are such phenomenal actors. You know, like when you have access to people like this, you want to try to pull the best possible performance and put them in the best possible situation you can.
So much of the movie, and this really feels like a play to me, is as often as not, characters are speaking in asides to themselves. It's almost like the equivalent of the thought balloons from comics.
Yeah, and I mean, we use a lot of those techniques in the film. It's funny because, you know, talking to Phil Lord and Chris Miller, we would worry sometimes that we had too many scenes of people standing together talking in rooms. And then Phil said, the funny thing is, those scenes of people together talking in rooms are kind of like some of the best scenes in the film. They're kind of what are making the film work on a certain level. That the things that you might often try to avoid having too much of, again, in a quote-unquote animated film for families. But I think that thing that could be seen as a weakness, I think, was a real strength of our film and a strength of this process, is that as opposed to trying to steer ourselves away from it, we leaned into all of those in the room scenes. I mean, Miles and his parents in the counselor's office was one of the first scenes that we got to a point where we actually felt comfortable showing it to anyone outside of our core team, because, you know, you're incredibly self-conscious with rough animation and rough voice work. But that was the first scene that we started getting animated and we felt comfortable showing, as well as early scenes between Gwen and her dad, George. Those are the scenes that actually came together. And because of them coming together, it enabled us to tell the rest of that, let's be honest, pretty bonker story.
It's funny because all these scenes you're talking about, people talking in a room, are really, and I hate to put it this way, the heart of what old school Marvel comics were about, which is to say, yes, melodrama. And that idea of emotional play, because the action scenes were meaningless. I mean, that was always, for me as a kid growing up, the difference between Marvel comics and DC comics was that at some point we had some idea what the emotional stakes were. And before each battle scene in this movie, there is that kind of conversation that kind of lays out what the stakes are for the character. And almost as if at some point this feels like sometimes the fights get in the way of that attempt to sort of understand themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, think back. Okay. X-Men. Who didn't love X-Men? X-Men, philosophically, as we, you and I probably know, was the classic Malcolm X versus Martin Luther King. You know, that was Professor X versus Magneto. And with the mutants kind of being a metaphor for people of color. I mean, they were these heady philosophical debates and ideas that I thought they were always trying to tackle in Marvel comics, particularly like back in the day. So I think you're absolutely right with that.
That part of Marvel, and there's so many wonderful touches, like, you know, the editor's notes that appear in sort of throwaway panels flying across the screen, which is to remind us what's going on. But for me, one of the great things too, just as an aside, is you get a chance to sort of show the grace and the pleasure that those spider characters take in just swinging above the city, which is something that the live action movies can't quite get right.
That was one of my favorite early scenes. And it's funny because when Miles and Gwen first get reunited and they kind of go on like a, you could almost call it like a swinging date. They just go swinging through the city, and it gives us a wonderful chance to kind of, rather than just have still exposition, to have like that kind of laid out while they're in motion, heading from one place to another. And then it ends with them at this clock tower at the old, what I used to call the Williamsburg Bank Building when I grew up in Brooklyn. That's why we set it there, because I was like, yeah, back when I was a kid, there was like one skyscraper in Brooklyn. That was it. So how about in Miles World, that's still the tallest building. So we have them go to the Williamsburg Bank Tower and then have this moment, which that almost got cut out of the film, them at the clock tower.
Really?
Yes, it almost got cut out of the film completely. And I'm so happy that it managed to stay in there, because I've talked about this before, but you know, films like Cameron Crowe's Say Anything were like really influential to me. And I love the kind of flirtiness and having Miles and Gwen have a moment, a quiet moment. The only quiet moment they have together in the entire film to kind of try to speak to each other, but not quite be able to get out the words that they want to say in this way that teenagers do, that we all did when we were teenagers. And it's like, that takes time. It takes valuable time to build a scene like that out. If it were live action, you wouldn't question it. But in animation, it's like, does this scene need to be here? Is this scene too long? And again, I'm so happy that it got to stay, because think about all the things we accomplish with them swinging. We get our exposition. We learn what Gwen's been up to. We also, something that's not said, when we ended the first film, Miles was just barely getting his feet as Spider-Man, but he wasn't very competent. So how can we show, while also giving the exposition, that Miles is now as formidable and as competent a spider person as Spider-Gwen? Why not have them do a game of horse while they're swinging to the clock tower? You see what I mean? So it was very much like, oh, now we know that Miles can do anything that Gwen did. Whereas at the end of the first film, we knew that there was no way in the world Miles could pull off a lot of the stuff that Gwen did. You know, we gave him a massive growth spurt. So we accomplish both these things with the dialogue, but we also accomplish a lot of things with the action in that scene. And it's something that I you can tell by my excitement that I'm thrilled that it survived. And I'm thrilled that it's something that made people lean in and connect to these characters and root for them.
You know, it's funny because you were talking about X-Men, and one of the sort of visual sort of influences on the film to me, and both the films, Into the Spider-Verse and this, I don't know if you know the Marvel artist Bill Sienkiewicz.
Are you kidding me? He worked on our film.
He worked on this film. Okay, because I can see it. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bill worked on this film. I mean, obviously, the first one, the design of Kingpin was heavily influenced by Bill Sienkiewicz's work. I actually just chatted with him a couple of days ago at our rap party. Bill Sienkiewicz and Art Adams are my two favorite comic artists of all time. So yeah, you're not crazy to pick up on that.
Wow. So we'll wrap up with my guest telling me I'm not entirely wrong. I will thank Kent Powers for doing this. His movie, Try to Catch It If You Can, and Not on the Plane with No Sound, is across the Spider-Verse. I can't thank you enough for your time. Thank you so much for doing this.
It's my pleasure, man. So great to chat with you.
Oscar nominee Kent Powers, who brings his POV to the MCU as co-director of Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Takes, original and reimagined, can be heard at kcrw.com/thetreatment. That's where I can be heard too. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest not only has the rare occurrence of having two films come out in the same year, but two films shot probably like four blocks away from each other.
That too. I love that. I didn't think about that. That's a good one.
See, thank you. I'm just trying to keep you awake. My guest, of course, is Calmatic. His two films are White Men Can't Jump and House Party. You may have heard of those titles before. He's brought them into the 21st century. And listen, one of the things I think is really funny about both these movies, they're both about guys with anger management issues. And I wonder if that was something that you just wanted to like sort of make play, because it's really funny how that plays out in both of these films.
Yeah, I think it's just mainly like people going through it, right? And I think like post-pandemic, like 85% of us are going through it. And I think in the end, they realize that, you know, it's not that serious. You know what I'm saying? Just like relax, live life, have fun. You know what I'm saying? And everything will probably fall into place eventually.
Because in that neighborhood, there's a lot of like rage anyway, because I live in Leimert Park. So I feel like you just sort of see somebody just go walk down the street, just turn and you go, urgh.
Yeah.
Especially in the last few years, that kind of free-floating rage that really feels like it comes out in a very different way in Los Angeles, either sort of thematically or sort of kind of subtly part of both these movies.
I think the rage that we feel is because we're so close to the dream, and it's within our reach, but we can't quite get it. You know what I mean? I think, you know, even in House Party, like the whole point of the movie was like, there's these two kids who live in South Central who are trying to live the dream. They live in South Central. They live in Leimert Park.
That's not South Central. Come on now.
One of them lived in Leimert Park. Another one lived in South Central, like off of Vermont. But the idea is that, you know, you can live in the hood and be 20 minutes away from LeBron's house. Like you can look up in the hills and see the Hollywood sign and be, you know, in a low income neighborhood. And so the idea is like some people see that as a slap in the face and other people use that as motivation. So I think that's kind of the yin and yang with both of those characters. And even in White Man Can't Jump, you know, we got Kamal who like lived in the jungles, went to Dorsey, was supposed to go league, but now he has to like, you know, work for like this Amazon type of company and like deliver boxes to like all the nice houses in Ladera Heights and Windsor Hills. And so he's,
and everybody who knew him.
Yeah. So he's faced with that reality that he didn't make it every day. So I think that's the quote unquote rage that I think we sense on a daily basis. Is like we see it. It's right in our face. It's like it's so dense, this neighborhood, and we have to like navigate it every day. That sucks for some people, man.
I feel like a lot of these movies are kind of influenced by hip hop. And that's where that everybody's on the hustle.
Yeah.
You know that great line from that old song, I'm the best rapper in my apartment complex?
Yeah.
There's somebody like that in both these movies.
Yeah.
So the world is like two-dimensional for them, and it feels like they can touch these things. And the other guy wants to be very realistic and say, no, this is what I have to. I mean, in both cases, the guy goes, I have to do this.
Yep.
I need to do this.
Yep.
I need to do this. And you made two movies back-to-back about these kinds of pulls between dreamers and guys who have their feet on the ground. Does this feel in some ways like your story? Like you, are you that guy in the middle who both dreamed and was on the hustle?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think growing up, like it was tough for me to like really follow my dreams. Cause in the back of my head, I'm like, man, this really might not work. I remember my dad, he wanted me to work at the post office. And I was like, I'm not working at the post office, man. And it's funny because like the way it worked, it was like every day he would leave to go to work, I would be on a computer doing something, you know, music video wise, trying to like, you know, work on my craft. And then he would leave and I would go out in the world and like hustle and get clients and all this kind of stuff. And then come back and then get back on the computer. And then he would come home and see me still on the computer. So he like, you've been sitting here all day, you know what I'm saying? Just playing on a computer. So I was like, man, let me go get this job so I can, you know, get him off my back. And I actually applied to the post office, but I failed the driver's test and I didn't get the job. And so it kind of made me like feel like, not that I'm worthless, but that like I'm a mess up. I'm a F up. You know what I'm saying? And it kind of put me at a crossroads. Like I could either like, you know, find a job or I can go harder at what I want to do and just kind of like live this dream. And I think at that moment, that's when, you know, my hustle upped and I started like, you know, spreading my network and getting different clients to work with. And my name started spreading across the city. And next thing you know, I'm starting to actually make real money off of directing music videos.
Both of these films are about ambition.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if these films coming to you, given who you are, given the way you've led your life, it sort of fit into, in some weird way, the way you've led your life about trying to fulfill an ambition that's not conventional.
Yeah, I mean, for me, man, the way I was raised, like, I never had any limits, right? Like, I feel like every dream that I've had, you know, my family and my parents, like, they supported it. And so, you know, it always felt like, why not dream big? Why not try to obtain that big goal? Like, I think, you know, it's funny because I used to play baseball when I was younger. And I remember,
what position did you play?
I was a second baseman. You know what I'm saying? And it's funny because I remember, like, there would be times when we would be down and, like, the last inning, we'd be down by, like, 2 runs or something like that. And everybody's on the bench like, oh, yeah, this game is over. And I'm like, no, like, let's get up. And I'm, like, damn near on the verge of tears, like, you know, rally caps and everything just, like, on the edge of the fence. Like, let's go. And everybody looking at me like, I'm crazy. And I'm like, nah, we can win this game. Even talking about baseball, like, growing up, like, I played at a very special little league that, like, really changed the way I look at society. And we were really good, and it was a lot of camaraderie and family and, like, encouragement, and we were really good, and we used to win a lot of games that way. And, like, when I got to high school and it wasn't the same way, it was, like, really disheartening. But at the same time, like, I knew deep down, like, what was possible, and so I always kept that, you know, in me.
It's funny too, because both the movies kind of start with father figures. We got Bill Bellamy, who could have been in a 90s movie. I'm sure you auditioned for House Party and White Man Can't Jump. And Lance Reddick. You got father figures starting both movies. I want to talk to you about that.
Yes, it's even more interesting because my father starts House Party, you know, when they're coming down off the Hollywood sign and there's that car driving down the street. My dad is in the car right there.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, so it's like even more father figures, right? It's like, boom, my dad, and then we go into Bill Bellamy. But yeah, man, I mean, I think that's kind of like my memory of me growing up. Like, my dad was always involved in my life. He was there to teach me about music, but also teach me how to work hard. And he was also there to give me that caution to make sure I was doing things right so that I can live a better life than he lived. You know what I mean? I think that's kind of what I wanted to establish. That's what I wanted to establish with the Bill Bellamy character. And even with the Lance Reddick character,
White
Man Can't Jump, Benji, you know, he's kind of like a Lonzo Ball character,
sure,
right? Lamar Ball, sorry. But the idea is, like, what if the reason why LeVar Ball is the way he is because he has an illness that he's hiding and he knows one day he's not going to be here. So it's not that he's just trying to be this, like, big braggadocious character and, like, take the spotlight away from his kids. He's like, let me give my kids the biggest boost that I can give them so one day when I'm gone, like, they'll be in a better position.
Both these movies, these fathers are pushing their sons.
Yes.
And that's a really interesting image to have with black characters, to see a black father trying to get behind a black son. I just want to talk about that because that's a pointed thing to do. It's an unusual thing to see in movies.
Yeah.
And have it be in two movies back to back is really unusual.
Yeah. And I think ultimately, you know, even in my relationship with my father, like, I feel like all the pushing and the comforting, like, all the emotions that go with that relationship, they're all based out of the intentions of, you know, making sure that they live a better life than their son lives a better life than they live. You know, they've gone through all these trials and tribulations and they've seen things play out over and over again. And, like, you know, the protection that they're giving their son, whether it be in the form of pushing them on the court or making sure they get a job or whatever, is to make sure they don't go through the same things they went through.
I can't think of two movies being made back-to-back in the same neighborhood.
I know.
My guess is done at Calmatic. His films are House Party and White Man Can't Jump. White Man Can't Jump on Hulu, House Party on Max. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. People react to these movies just by hearing the title. I bet a lot of people who haven't even seen the originals are just sort of trying to beat you down for, how dare you take on these classics?
Yeah, it's funny because even Jack Harlow, who's a star of White Man Can't Jump, like, he was like, yeah, I should probably go watch the movie now. Like, he hadn't even seen it. You know what I mean? And it's like, you can't blame him. I mean, like, he's like, you know, I think he's like 25 years old or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like, you know, White Man Can't Jump was just like on TV all the time. You know what I mean? So it's a lot of people that just didn't see it. You know what I'm saying? And so that's fine. And I think that's the whole point of us remaking this, is to kind of remix the story and bring it back for, you know, the new audience. You know, we did this one scene in Orange County where it was, we're right next to this junior high school, and word got out that Jack Harlow was there. And so during lunch, the whole school came over and they were yelling, "We want Jack! We want Jack!" And, you know, he went out there and it was like the Beatles. Like, everyone was screaming and he was like signing autographs and slapping hands. And at that moment, I was like, you know, that's our demographic. Like, that's the people that are going to watch this movie and love this movie.
But there's also this kind of sense of the of like you sort of the urban and the surreal that we can take back to Old Town Road.
Yeah.
And that is what House Party really is. I mean, that's sort of like, yeah, at some point you cross a line and there's a koala and, yeah, and Lena Waithe. And then there's the Illuminati. But all these things, this idea is sort of saying, well, you know, things are so crazy. Why not just push it a little bit further?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned Old Town Road because I directed that video. You know, when the song first came out and they were like, yo, write a treatment on this. I was like, okay, let's see. Like,
but this was before the song blew up.
Yeah, way before the song blew up. I remember my first response to the email when they sent me the song was, is this a joke? and they were like, no. And so I was like, you know what? This feels like something that Atlanta would do. This feels like an episode of Atlanta. This feels like...
Yes, Paperboy would do that.
Yeah, like some random dude from the hood like made a Western song and now he's blowing up. Like, that just feels like an episode of Atlanta. So that's what I did with the video. And that tone, the tone of Atlanta was very inspirational to me as a, like, you know, when I started to make those bigger films, and I feel like I hit the head on it.
So you must have been thrilled when you have the Atlanta Brain Trust writing the movie.
Exactly. And so that's kind of how that all happened. It's like when I heard that they were writing the movie, I literally, you know, DM one of them like, yo, I need first dibs on House Party. And, you know, a couple years later, you know, they hit me up like, yo, can you pitch on it? And I was like, yep. And then we did it and it all worked out. And it was crazy because, like, all those elements in the movie, like, whether it be the Kid Cudi moment or the Illuminati moment, like, or the koala, like, all
that reminded me of Old Town Road video. That's kind of, yeah, like going from reality to surreality in the same
but
shot.
But also, like, is it surreal? Like, I don't know. Like, that kind of stuff could happen. You know what I mean? Like, and especially when, once again, going back to, like, the perception of L.A., like, everyone thinks there's an Illuminati and all that. Like, why not? Like, let's go in there. Let's, like, play with that. Let's prove them right. You know what I'm saying? And I think that's kind of what we wanted to do, is just, like, have fun and make people feel weird.
So many people in these two movies are new to movies. I mean, you talked about Jack.
Yeah.
And I wonder what your first conversation with him was. This is a lot to ask of somebody, because when you first introduce us to him, he's talking nonstop.
Yeah.
And he's got to be, like, real in this moment, but also playing something, because he's acting something, pretending to be real. So that's a lot to ask of somebody.
Yeah, I mean, when they first brought up his name, I think it was one of the interns was just like, what about Jack Harlow?
Yeah.
And then we hit him up, and it's funny because his manager had been trying to get me to do music videos for him for years. I had a meeting with him over Zoom at first just to kind of fill him out, and he was super, you know, on point. And I think, and he carried that on when he came into the room and auditioned. And I think Jack, his secret weapon is confidence. I feel like it's almost like, I feel like he tells himself before he goes into a room, like, be as confident as possible. I feel like we don't do that to ourselves. Like, we just kind of, like, once we enter the room, all that goes to the side and we just forget about that. But I feel like he's making a conscious effort to be confident, and that is contagious. And, like, people are attracted to that.
Both these movies are in their way kind of about history. I mean, because there's this space that the original House Party occupies, and the music in it goes from Luther Vandross to Flavor Flav. I mean, so that's a big jump. And there's the same kind of jump in your movie, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And in your House Party, in terms of the songs you picked, there's a big historical jump in it.
I love music, man. Music is my first love. And it's just like, that's one of my favorite parts of making a movie, is like adding the score. You know what I'm saying? So even, you know, at the very beginning of House Party, we hear a West Coast pop lock, right? And obviously, as California knows how to party, and it's just like a bunch of, you know, metaphors there or whatever. But at the same time, my dad used to play that song all the time when we were driving around LA in his convertible. Thinking about history, he used to tell me, you know, like in that song where they say, you know, pop locking at the Howard Johnson, the Sheraton, he used to tell me, like, yo, back in the day, we used to have parties at the hotels, at the Sheraton, and I'm like, I was just kind of been obsessed with that story, you know what I mean? And so it's just, like, great to kind of start the film off with that, and, like, paying homage to my dad, seeing my dad driving down the street. You know, I kind of look at myself as, even though I'm making these stories that are, you know, that have a lot of depth to them, I feel like I'm also a documentarian, right? Where I'm just documenting the culture and, like, this is what we're doing now. You know, why not every 10 years, maybe even every 5 years, we have a film that documents what the young kids are doing in the culture through the story of them throwing a party. I feel like you can document what they dress like, how their hair is, what music they're playing. Like, I feel like 100 years from now, we can look back at, like, the almanac of house parties and just like know like what the culture is and what it's going through. Like, I feel like that's such a beautiful thing to do.
I'm guessing you grew up hearing Lovely Day with your dad, and that's the last song in White Man Can't Jump.
Oh, yeah, I grew up listening to that. I grew up listening to all kinds of stuff.
But that song, I mean, specifically sounds like a song you would hear in the car with your dad.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, we used to play everything from, like, I could just name random groups that he used to play, and you're going to be like, damn. Like he used to play Pieces of a Dream. You know about Pieces of a Dream?
3, 4, 5, 4 Pieces of a Dream? No, I have no idea what you're talking about.
You know what I'm saying? But, like, when's the last time you heard Pieces of a Dream? You know what I mean? Or, like, he would play, like, Najee. You know what I mean? And, like, that's the kind of music that I, like, that's what, you know, gave me the love for music and soul and chords and jazz. And, you know, like, this is definitely a topic for another interview, but like my uncle is Roy Ayers.
Wait,
like,
what?
Yeah, Roy Ayers is
so
my uncle.
So you relate to Nabil?
Yeah, Nabil. I just met Nabil.
He was on my show not too
long
ago.
The funny thing is I met him because of the whole story. Like I saw that.
Oh, the book? Oh my God.
Yeah, I saw the book and I was like, oh, I gotta talk to him. That's my uncle? But yeah, so basically, long story short, my dad's dad is Roy Ayers Sr. and his stepbrother is Roy Ayers Jr. So I think even him exposing me to Roy Ayers at a young age was just like the craziest thing. You know what I mean? And so I think like I've always had this love for just like sound and history and trying to find
Roy Ayers
ways.
Goes from jazz to funk.
Yeah. And it's a very South Central thing. You know what I mean? And it's L.A. People don't realize he went to Jefferson High School. You know what I mean? Like he learned how to play the xylophones because he got his pair of mallets from Lionel Hampton on Central Avenue. My grandfather was there playing the piano. You know what I mean? So like that's how all that stuff happened. You know what I mean? So that's how deep some of these references get for the movie. And so like it might just come in the form of just like hearing a song, but to me it means so much more than that.
Well, I can't wait for your next movie. Hopefully be actually about you and not remakes. My guest who's really taking us deep into the quiet storm is Calmatic. His films as director, his first two films that came out within months of each other are House Party and White Man Can't Jump. Thank you so much for doing this, Steve. Thank you.
Oh man, thank you, man.
The New House Party is streaming on Max. The White Man Can't Jump remake is streaming on Hulu. Both are from the director of the Old Town Road video, Calmatic. Everything old is new again. Next, The Treat is a film that took over director Tim Bogart's life when he was a film student. Past treats can be heard at kcrw.com/thetreat. It's The Treat. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Art as larceny is what Tim Bogart, director of Spinning Gold, practices. His Theft, a film that reinvented the musical.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2. My name is Timothy Scott Bogart, and this is The Treat. I think one of the most consequential creative experiences of my life was seeing All That Jazz for the first time. And it was in a retrospective theater, so it was years after it had come out. And I'd always heard about it and thought, oh, that's that movie about Broadway. And interestingly, my father from Casablanca Records had actually released the soundtrack of All That Jazz, but for whatever reason, I had never seen it. They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway. And so I was actually at NYU Film School, and I was living across the street from the Quad Cinema, and I saw All That Jazz one day. And I was like, oh, I guess I'll check that out. And I went to the 10 o'clock in the morning showing, and 2.5 hours later, I couldn't get out of my seat. I had been so impacted in every way about the power of Bob Fosse's treatment of every tool in the filmmaker's toolbox. Every single frame I thought was a revelation. And so I stayed for the next showing, and the next showing, and I stayed for 5 showings. Now I was at NYU Film School. And of course, this was at the time where we really didn't have video access at that time. So I went and got a 60mm camera. And I know this is potentially controversial, but convinced the projectionist, who was a friend of mine, to let me film All That Jazz for my own personal homework assignment. I had a Steenbeck up in my apartment, And for the entire year that year at film school, my most important film class was analyzing every frame on my Steenbeck of Bob Fosse's brilliant All That Jazz.
Bye-bye, life. Bye-bye, happiness.
And to this day, it's my go-to. Hello. Whenever I need inspiration, I go back and I watch All That Jazz, all the way to my film Spinning Gold about my father literally ripping off the final sequence of Roy Scheider singing his final moments of life. I had Jeremy Jordan play my father do the same. So I tried to tip my hat a little bit to the most inspirational creative experience that I had the joy of happening accidentally on back at film school.
Sweet caress.
If you're going to steal, right, steal from the best, and I steal often from the best, but most importantly, that movie just absolutely rocked my creative world, and to this day, decades later, I still marvel at what he achieved in that film.
This is 1979 magnum opus, All That Jazz. The Treat, from Spinning Gold director Tim Bogart. Earlier editions of The Treat, such as one featuring John Hamburg, are heard at kcrw.com/thetreat. The Treat, visions of achievement that change the way artists see the world. The show is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Yes, we did have help this week from Anna Buss and Laura Gandarajan. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
She sure looks happy.
I sure am blue.
He sure is blue.
I sure am blue.
He sure is blue.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.